And if we could open this session with the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. In accordance with our singleness of purpose, only alcoholics will participate in this meeting. This is an open meeting and all are welcome. Public relations are important. Good public relations save lives. We seek publicity for AA principles, not AA members. Personal anonymity at the public level is the cornerstone of our public relations policy. The 11th tradition is a constant reminder that personal ambition has no place in AA. And with that, we'll turn it back over to Johnny.
Well, I'm still Johnny and I'm still alcoholic. Well, to the best of my ability, I have tried to explain to you my beliefs and my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous up to and through the fifth step of this program of recovery, plus some of my own personal opinions and things that I believe very deeply in. What I very believe probably more deeply than anything else is that I love alcoholics. And I know way down deep in my soul, from which I live and breathe most all of my life, is that alcoholics of my type either go crazy or they commit suicide or they get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. There isn't any options left open for them over a period of time. And so I'm very, very, very conscious of alcoholics and alcoholism. And based on my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, these things that I have seen happen in Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes scar me and sometimes win me, but I believe basically in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe basically that all those other things that are introduced into various programs are fine and dandy. I just believe they don't have anything or any place in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I have come to believe, because I've come to believe that alcoholics of my type are always looking for a way out anyhow. I don't believe anybody ever comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and it's not looking for the open door. I mean, they're always looking for a way out. We're always looking for an escape route. I always was. And the deeper I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and more I had people around me who were more concerned with saving my life and they weren't hurting my feelings or going against what my opinions had been, you know, what I thought was really right, and, you know, in my egotistical concern for other people, which I had none, the more I've come to understand that the more powerful thing upon the face of this earth, the most powerful thing that's on the face of this earth, is the God-honest truth. And truth, as I understand it, is based on the experiences of the people who have come to Alcoholics Anonymous. My experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I have seen a lot of things come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous that haven't done alcoholics of my type any good whatsoever. Matter of fact, they've killed a lot of alcoholics of my type. I'm not saying that they don't do good for a lot of people and a lot of things, and I'm not saying that compassion doesn't have a place in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I believe truth is compassion. I believe that if I declare to you that I love you, then I owe you the truth as I see it, and through my experience designates me to explain to you what I believe and what I have seen here. My old sponsor, Norm Alpey, used to tell me, "What you are, speak so loud I can't hear a word you say." But sitting around in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, not just once in a while, but on an average of 4 or 5 times a week, I sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous over all these years, and I have seen many, many things here. And what I have seen in Alcoholics Anonymous is what my experience brings down, and what these steps come to mean more to me today than they did when I was first going through them. Because I've come to understand that it's a matter of life and death. And another thing I've come to understand in Alcoholics Anonymous is how very complicated people try to make everything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I understand the reason for that too. Because my ego, being as selfish and self-centered as I am, demands from me credit for everything that happens to me. Good. It demands that it's something that I have, that I am entitled to, because I am so good that I am entitled to all these things. My ego demands these things. My ego also says to me that there must be some course of action or some work that I can do to make me better. And what that says to me, screw you, God, I can do it. Basically, that's what it says. I know people who have spent a lifetime in Alcoholics Anonymous writing inventories and working on their shortcomings. I mean, they just write. And that's where we are right now. We just got through with the fifth step where I admitted to God and to myself and to another human being the very nature of my wrong. It says at the bottom of page 75 that returning home from the find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have admitted anything, and this is the heavy stuff here, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. We're building something here. We're doing something here. We're walking this way of life so we'll have an arch that we can walk over into this happy freedom. It says very simply, have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? I mean, you can't build a house without a good solid foundation. And so far what we have done, if we're painstaking about this phase of our development, my experience is this, is that we have built a foundation. We haven't got the house yet, and we haven't been sheltered from the storm, but we have the foundation. If we have been painstaking about this phase of our development, we have this solid foundation built on absolute bedrock that we know is right. Have we tried to make mortar without sand? I don't know how many of you ever, I'm not much of a construction, but I do know that if you're going to make concrete, you need sand and some other stuff to mix it up. And so you just can't say, oh, that's part way, or I've taken part of this. And you hear people say, well, you know, you take it this way and take it that way. You know, I hope that by anything else, when I read precisely to you, that you didn't try to think it meant anything but precisely. I probably did for a while. And it says on the top of page 6, where you really get into steps 6 and 7, and in our book, steps 6 and 7 are just 2 paragraphs. And they're just 2 very short little prayers. They say, we look at step 6, we have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them all? And there's that little line in there, which means, end of one thought, the beginning of another, every one. If we still cling to something, we will not let go, will we ask God to help us be willing. That's all. And then comes step 7, which I think really is another one of those funny little things that says what it means, but very few people hear it. It says this, if we can answer, if I'm not ready to have God help us be willing, when ready I say something like this, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, not just what I want you to have. I want you to have all of it. I'm willing, here I am, take with me, do with me what you will. Here I am. I pray that you remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Now, a lot of people read that, I suppose, and I did for a long time, and I thought, God, Take away all my defects of character. Make me as pure as snow out there. You know? And then I found out a couple years later that he hadn't. Oh, I guess I'm not worthy. He hasn't removed all my defects of character, so I better go back and work on them. I think I'll work on anger. I think I'll work on lust. The harder I work on them, the more angry I become, and the more lustful I become. I just can't work on things. I do not work well on things. It does not say that. It does not say, take away all my defects of character. It does not say that at all. This is what it says. I pray that you remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. That's all. I don't even know what's supposed to be removed. I haven't got a clue what's supposed to be removed. All I know is that he's going to take enough of me away from me so I will be useful to him and to my fellows, whatever it may be. Whatever those defects are, I can't make them go away. I can't understand them and cast them aside. I can't do any of those kind of things. I just have to trust, for the first time in my life, that God is going to do something for me that I can't do for myself. There's a big difference between saying, I believe in God, and then I trust in God. Big difference. If I ask you all, how many of you believe in God? Everybody say, yeah, I believe in God. I believe that. How many I trust in God? There might be a different story there. You know, I mean, really. Remove from me every one of my defects of character, which will stand between me, my usefulness to you, God, and to my fellows, you. That's all. Which will make me useful in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all. Or useful in my community, or useful in my family, or useful for whatever it is. Not all. Not, you know, to be driven or be struck clean as the driven snow is impossible. I'm a basic human being with wants and likes, dislikes, shortcomings, all these things that I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous with me. I still have them all. I remember one time, one of the funniest things I ever heard, I heard a guy say, I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I put the plug in a jug. I'll put my seat in that seat in there, and God remove from me anger. God remove from me lust. God removed all my defects of character. God remove from me. I'm not angry anymore. After the meeting, I went over and spilled a cup of coffee on him. You'd be surprised how quick God gave him back his anger. I mean, I think it's totally egotistical to believe that I have the ability to do anything other than show up here and do what I'm asked to do. I believe it's totally egotistical to believe that God would do something for me that he won't do for everybody else. I believe that's totally egotistical. I don't believe there's a single human being in this world who isn't any more important, is any less important in God's eyes than I am. I don't believe that. And I don't buy any kind of a definition or any type of a thought process or anybody who believes that there's anything more special about them than there is anybody else. I couldn't buy that God as a child. I can't buy it now. I believe that when I act like one of his children, he treats me like one of his children. When I act like a jerk, then I get to take the heat for it. You know, I cannot play victimization on anything and blame anybody else for any bad actions that I take. I can't. I heard a guy ask a question. One of the questions you always get asked, if you ever do a workshop, an AA workshop, where they ask you questions after you give a little talk, is one of the questions they always ask is, how do you deal with anger? I don't deal with anger very well. I don't deal with it at all. I don't deal with anything. I just try not to place myself in any place where I can become angry. That's all. It doesn't say that I don't get angry. You know, it doesn't mean that, you know, I don't do it. But since the bad thing about getting angry and making an ass out of yourself is, now I'm in a program where I got to go back and make amends. I don't like that. I don't like making amends, you know, particularly to my inferiors. You know what I mean? I mean, just people who are beneath me. Jesus, you know, I mean, you go out and you know, we were talking about it at lunch today about, you know, one of the things that my sponsor taught me by his actions when I was doing Alcoholics Anonymous is how he treats other people. Not necessarily in Alcoholics Anonymous, but how he treats people out there who can't fight back, you know, like little waitresses and where you have lunch, or little people who are driving cars out there, retail clerks, you know, those type of people, what type of consideration you have for them, I suppose, or how you do that. He was very good at that, you know, very good at that. He was very good at being kind to people outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I noticed that because these people can't strike back. And you know, it's kind of, you know, people look at you kind of funny when you have to, a day later, you walk back into a restaurant and tell the waitress, Jesus, I act like a jerk the other day, I'm sorry, yelled at you. She'll look at you and say, I don't remember who you were, mister. You know, I never saw you before. You know? And you walk out and say, shit, I could have got away with it this time. You know, just, but you can't. You know, not if you're like me and these things eat at you and eat at you and eat at you and eat at you, which is what we're talking about here. Now we're getting ready. You know, we've had God, we've become willing to have God remove these defects of character, whatever he's going to take from us, so we'll be useful to him and to our fellows. Now we've got to come to the real, real test, ties these things together. It says, we made a list of all the people we'd harmed. And became willing to make amends to them all. Guy said to me, where's the list? And I said, you made it when you took inventory. If you took a four-column inventory the way it's outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you have a list. If you have one of those thousands of different type of guides, you know, I mean, you couldn't find the name in there if you wanted to. You're looking through all the weirdo things you're supposed to put down there. But there's a little outline in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, on how you're supposed to take an inventory. It's just a four-column inventory, you know. And then the list is the people that I'm resentful at, why I did it, and all so on and so forth. Got a list. And then, now it gives me a real chore. And somewhere in our writing it says, these are the steps to separate the men from the boys. Now I got to go out and make direct amends. I got to go out and make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And that's tough. That really is. I mean, you got to go to people and tell them you did things that you shouldn't tell them you did them to. You know what I mean? You got to go out and start making amends. You're going to have to start. I remember one time I was telling my sponsor about making this amends. I said, Jesus, you know, I don't want to take my money and give it to that guy that ain't your money. It's his money. You have money you owe him, you ain't got no money. It's his money. I mean, that's sick. And in my way of thinking, what do you mean I ain't got no money, for Christ's sake? You got money yet? Go pay your bills. Well, wait a minute. I want to go to the dance. I want to go out to dinner. Go pay your bills. Then if you got any left over, then you can go to the dance and go to dinner. Oh, that's not my priority. My priority is to amuse myself and be good to me. And then if there's anything left over, you can have it. But by the time I get through being good to me, there ain't nothing left over. Because I want it all. And that's just the nature of the beast. I don't know why that is. But that's the way it is. My sponsor was very, very, very thorough about that. Because for a very specific reason, as he told me, because it isn't until we get through with step 9, we which reads like this. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. It says, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Self-pity is a form of depression, in case you don't know it. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. It says, are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but they will always materialize if we work for them. I think it's amazing to me that they put those promises in there at the tail end of step 9. They did not come until after step 9. There are other promises in this book before you get to these things. Promises that most of us don't want to hear. Promises about what will happen to us if we don't do these things. Talk about things like, we may drink again. Somewhere in this book it says that any life based upon anything but spiritual principles is doomed for failure. Doomed for failure. Alcoholics like me, and I presume like you if you're here, need some type of a spiritual lifestyle. And what is spiritual? I believe that spiritual, to me, as spiritual as you can get, is doing what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. Or else let somebody know why you can't. That's what I believe is spiritual. Now, spiritual, to me, is not sitting around praying. I don't think that's spiritual. I think that's just praying. I believe it's spiritual, to me, sometimes, is sticking your hand out the window to make a left turn. That's what I believe. I believe it's spiritual, to me, sometimes, is being concerned about the person sitting next to you. I believe spiritual sometimes is being more concerned about other people than I am myself. I believe that's spiritual. I believe that spirituality is an action. I believe that doing things for others without no thought of reward whatsoever is spiritual. And the reason I know that to be true is because the most spiritual man that I have ever known in my life is a man, a gentleman by the name of Chuck Chamberlain. Everybody talked about what a great spiritual man he was. All these things. Chuck Chamberlain was a man of action. Chuck Chamberlain went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and tried to carry this message to alcoholics. And he did it for free and for fun, just because that's what he wanted to do. Now, if that's spiritual, I do that sometimes, for free and for fun, so that must be spiritual. If that is what some people think is a spiritual giant, because they thought he was spiritual, because he was, it was not because he sit around and prayed a great deal, or because he mouthed God every other word out of his mouth. It's because he put into action spiritual principles. He got out of himself, no matter what it was like out there, he would get out and go. Night after night after night after night, he got in that car, drove down off that mountain, went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He worked downtown. He lived way out in the country. He went to meetings downtown and then drove way out home in the country, came all the way back, worked the next day, and stayed in meetings 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, drove home. Night after night after night. He got down before it was popular, parked his car at airport, got on airplanes, and flew out and talked to people. Not because he wanted great audiences, because that's what he wanted to do, because they asked him to do it. He didn't sit around and said, have talk, we'll travel. Hello? He didn't do that. That's spiritual. My first sponsor, Norm Alpe, was like that. I watch these people. I watch them like, ooh, you wouldn't believe how I watch them. I think sometimes that I watched them just to see if I could pick out their flaws. You know, because I wanted to find some flaw in their character makeup so I could say, like a lot of jerks do, ha, 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 you ain't so slick after all, kids. But I just watched them. And by watching them, I was doing what they were doing. And so I didn't have time to find out what was wrong with them. I was so busy being caught up in what Chuck used to say was, I got lost doing the things in Alcoholics Anonymous that make me feel good. Got lost doing it. And in the sum total, it found me and God you. It's amazing to me. By doing these things, I got caught up into this magnificent thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got lost in the results. The results aren't mine. I can't sit down and predict to you what will happen to me as a result of doing certain things. I can't do that. I can't sit and tell you when I came to believe in God. I don't know. Just turn around one day and there it did. I believe there's a power greater than myself. Now, I was introduced to a God in a very strange way here. I was told to sit down and shut up and listen. I thought that was cruel. I wanted to visit from time to time with whoever would listen to me. You know. But my sponsor told me, sit down and shut up. Told me if I didn't want to listen, that was my business. Maybe somebody else did. He was teaching me another very spiritual thing. Consideration for you. So, that is a very spiritual principle, to be concerned about the person sitting next to me. Even though I am bored, and even though I don't like the speaker, or even I don't like the subject, or maybe I don't want to be there, maybe I'm frustrated, that doesn't mean that I should not respect the person sitting next to me. I should, if I wanted to be, if I claim to have some type of a spiritual program within grasp of my life, I should be willing to forsake my discomfort for the comfort of the person sitting next to me, which is a little thing called common courtesy, which very few self-centered, self-serving people like me have any glimpse of most of my life. Get out of my goddamn way. Do you understand? I gotta get there, whatever it is. Like them little kids under the Christmas tree. That's the way I ran through life like that. Get out of my way, for Christ's sake. On the freeway. Out! No, I'm out here. Move! No, they don't care. That's what I'm saying. And so we come into this thing, Alcoholics Anonymous, however, before we got to number one, and we're given a program of recovery which will build us. Now that we've got our foundation, and now with 6, 7, 8, and 9, we put up the shelter. Now we're in the house. Now we're sitting there warmed. But now we have another dilemma. Where are we going to get the fire for the fireplace? Oh, Jesus. Well, some folks would say, well, I think I'll just pray to God about that. Okay, God, bring me a cord of firewood. God, it's getting cold in here. Better hurry up, God. If you listen real careful, God will say to you, get a damned axe and go out and cut it down and carry it in there yourself. But I want to be spiritual and very godly. But I believe in God. So I'll just sit there and freeze to death waiting for him to deliver wood to me. I have a little saying that I usually tell people about things like that. Next time you get hungry, go lock yourself up in a closet and pray for a hot dog. When God squirts you one through the keyhole, call me. I'll take a snowplow to you, whatever. You know, I believe that I believe that God wants all things good and decent for me and for you. But I also believe that he wants me to go up and try to get them. That's what I believe. I believe that he wants me to go out and take actions, like his children take action, so he can reward me for acting like one of his, like my children. But my children, I know children, some people seem to think that I'm opposed to children. No, I'm not. I love children. I really do. I have little grandchildren. I just love them little rascals, even though they put peanut butter in my shoes and break my lamps, blame the other one for it, ride bicycles through my house. God, a little wild person. Run into the wall, pounces off. Oh, Grandpa, he did that. I love them. I love them little kids. You know, I just think that you ought to be able to take care of them. But that's the way I do. When my children act like my children, I will. But when they're out there getting loaded and running the streets, when you get tired, there's a story about that too. It seemed once upon a time, a long, long time ago, there were two brothers from this very wealthy family. And one of them was kind of a hip dude, you know, he's kind of slick. He went and told the old man, he said, look, I'm going to wait for you to die. I want my money now. I want to enjoy my money while you're alive. Blah, blah, blah. So the old man gave him his inheritance. He went out and squandered it. Spent all of his dough. Spent it. Just blew it. The book says in riotous living. Now, we know about riotous living, don't we? If anybody knows about riotous living, it's us. We're riotous living, all right. We like that riotous living business. If I get snowed in, I like to have some riotous living, I'll tell you that. But anyhow, he got all through, and the story says, he came to one day in a pig pen. And he looked up, and he was in the pig pen of his father's farm or wherever it was. He looked up and he said, my God, the servants in my father's house live better than I do. Tell you what I think I'm going to do. You know how we talk to ourselves in our moments of clarity. I think I'll just get up and go knock on Daddy's door and say, look, I know I screwed up, Pop. I know I really don't deserve anything, but could I just come and be a servant? Could I just come in? I don't want nothing. So he made this decision. And he got up, he started walking toward the house. Now, all the time, the old man is sitting up there in the second story of his house looking at the pig pen and seeing his son that he loved crawling around in the pigsty, eating pig food and stuff, eating pig pens. And all the time, he said, he just sat there and watched him, and probably like me, father who watched his daughter suffer through this thing for 10, 15 years, tears come to his eyes when he saw this pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization of the child that he loves, like all fathers. And he sit there, but the great thing about this father is, like God, he just sat there and watched him. Now you say, well, you know, if he was any kind of a loving father, he'd run down and snatch him up out of the pig pen and say, come on home. No, he didn't do that. He just sit there. When he started coming to the house, the old man ran out the house, met him on the porch and said, to the servants, bring a robe for my son, sandals for his feet, kill the fatted calf, my son has come home. That's what it amounts to. Trying to get back home, the old man's there, he's just waiting for us. That's what God's doing. God's just waiting for us to say, okay. Now I can't eat any more of this squill, baby. I'm sorry, Pop, you know what I mean? It's called pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I cannot stand any more of this slop. I'll just get up and go ask my father if I can be a servant in his house because I do not deserve to be one of his children. Now, the sad part about that story is this. The other brother. His brother was pissed. I mean, he said to the old man, Jesus, hey, what's going on here? Man, I've been standing here toiling in the fields, taking care of the house. Jackass went out there, lived it up, spent all the money. You ain't never gave me a robe, Sandal, you never told them to kill the fatted calf. All you did was say, sit down and eat. What is the deal here? And the old man looked at him and said, you don't seem to understand. My son was lost, but now he's home. But he's still my son. That's the way I think God is. That's my concept of God. I think that's the way. People want to know why God does all. God doesn't do anything. He does not do anything. He just sits there and smiles when we're acting like his children and weeps when we act like what we are, jackasses. That's what I believe. That's what this thing says to me. That's the promise here, that you get to go home. You get to quit wandering around in the darkness and the lostness out there. And we come into the house and we sit by the fire and they kill the fatted calf and put a ring on our finger and we just put our feet up on the hearth and get warmed by the fire. That's what this is. That's what happened to us if we're painstaking about this phase of our development. If we really get into Alcoholics Anonymous, not get sidetracked by all this mishmash, I don't want to, I don't think I have to, wait a minute, quite old, oh, I got a better idea. If we're just painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be sitting by the fire. And the people who aren't painstaking about this development will be standing out in the cold looking in the window, wondering what the hell's going on, when am I going to get mine? Which I did all my life. I stood out in the cold and peeked through the window all my life and said, Jesus, I wish I could just go in the candy store and have some candy. I didn't realize I had to go over and open up the door and walk in. You know, I just thought I was supposed to stand at the window and pee forever, and God was supposed to give me candy all the time, which is kind of an egotistical idea, but that's the way I live my life. So that's where we should be in Alcoholics Anonymous. We should be at the end of step 9. We should be sitting by the fireplace. We should be in a nice warm place like this. We should have coffee and we should have donuts and we should have sandals for our feet and robes for our shoulders and a ring for our finger. Because we're God's children and we've come home. Now how do we stay here? Well, that's what 10, 11, or 12 are about. Have we got any more questions? I hope that's what 10, 11, or 12 are about. It says, why do many AA members look down on or criticize those that are very active? Maybe because they ain't active. I don't know. I really don't know. But I really do, I know this, and this is something I learned from Chuck a long, long time ago. I learned many things from Chuck. Fathers are supposed to teach their children many things. And Chuck Chamberlain was my father, for all intents and purposes. He never sired me, but he was my father. He said to me one time that nobody would say anything about me at all to deliberately tear me down. The only reason anybody would say anything bad about me is to make themselves look better. That's all. You know, if you don't want to be criticized in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't believe in anything. Don't stand up for what you believe in. Don't do anything. Just shoot around here and sit around in the back and don't do nothing. And nobody will ever criticize you. They won't even know you're here. And more importantly, they won't even know when you leave. Because you'll be like one of those nameless faces of people who drift in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, do nothing, stay for a short while, sit on the porch, maybe have a cup of coffee, and never come in out of the cold and sit by the fire. I, personally, would rather be the criticized as the critic, personally. Because I'll tell you one thing, the higher all the water you go, the better target you make. That's one of Clancy's. Thought I'd give him a little juice before I get carried on there too much. I don't know why, but I'll tell you something that I believe in. I believe that 95% of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous are perfectly willing to let the other 5% do everything. I'm perfect. But I tell you, there's a statistic that Clancy quotes all the time that really makes me tie two things like that together. Do you know that 95% of the people in the world today, with all the help and availability and notoriety of alcoholism and its treatments, that 95% of the alcoholics in the world still die drinking? I don't know how those two statistics fit, but it's... I want to be in that 5%. So I'm going to just keep moving around here. If I have to be criticized for saving my life, so be it. Can the steps help an alcoholic that has been sexually abused? I don't know. I tell you, I'll work the steps if one of you want to sexually abuse me. I don't know. That's one of those non-answerable questions. Not you, you long-haired weirdo. I'll pick out who I want to be abused by. I don't know. I know. It seems to be a thing that's coming up in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot. I don't know. I probably abuse people, but I really don't know. That's a question I can't answer because I have no experience in it. See, what I believe is that was then, and this is now. I believe that that's part of the amends. I mean, it sounds kind of sick to say that somebody sexually abused you and you got to go make amends to them. But there's a destructive side to the nature, too. You can't sit and say, if I hadn't been sexually abused as a child, I could have been something better today. That being abused has recessed me and held me down. That's victimization. And the only thing that victimization does for people like me, I suppose people like you, is this, that it automatically relieves me from guilt. Because it's not my fault, it's your fault, you son of a bitch. See? If this book is what it says it is, and I believe it to be godly inspired for the alcoholic. The number one offender in alcohol, the number one offender and killer to alcoholics is resentments. I cannot live in resentment, no matter what the resenter, what would happen to me because I'm resentful. I was beaten as a child and as a young teenager. Thousands and thousands of times, indescribable, sometimes so bad that they wouldn't let my mother see me for days, by policemen because of my attitude and because of my nature. I have been shocked with electrotherapy programs. I have been doused with high pressure fire hoses. That might be classified as abuse. I don't know. But I cannot live tied to those things in my life. I can't live resentful at policemen all my life. One of my best friends is a policeman. One of my best friends is a policeman. I can't live in resentment at the policeman. I can't relive resentment at the people who wheeled me on that gurney and strapped me down and gave me those electroshock treatments either. Or the doctor who diagnosed me as clinically insane and did those things to me, who tried to talk me into lobotomies. I can't live in that type of a thing. I have to be free from that kind of stuff and go on about my business. I'm in a new world here. I'm in a brand new house, a brand new thing. That's the wreckage of my past. I can't live there. I can't be bound to the past by something that happened in the past that I have no control over it. That doesn't mean it was a video camera, for Christ's sakes. You could have a very wealthy speaker talking to you today, I'll tell you that. But I didn't know this thing. So I just, I hope it doesn't. I know it's a very painful thing, and I know it's a very degrading thing, I know it's a very humiliating thing. But I pray to God that whoever has this type of situation does not let it tie them and bind them into a thing that will destroy their lives full of resentments. I hope that they can get on about the business of life and realize that that's something that happened and there's nothing you can do about it. I can't go back and change a thing I said an hour ago. If I said it, I'm sorry maybe, but I can't change it. But I can't say, oh, I wish I'd feel I'd have been better if I hadn't said that. I didn't like it anymore. I can't do that. I got to say, God, I'm sorry. I'll try to offend you again tomorrow in a different way. You know what I mean? See, that's what I'm saying. I don't mean to make light of it, and I don't mean like to say it's something. I know to people who are, because I've talked to and sponsored people who deeply sexually abused by members of their family. And I'm not talking about just women. I'm talking about guys. And I'm talking about all this stuff, and I put my arm around them, you know, if they'll let me, you know what I mean? And try to comfort them and say, I don't understand this kind of situation, but I do know that if you don't rid yourself of it, you're going to be locked in the bondage of this resentment for the rest of your life, and it'll destroy you. You got to get out of it. I mean, it's like looking in the rearview, fine, the rearview mirror is fine to look at it, but God, you can't just keep your eye back there forever. You got to... got to do this. So God love you. If you've had these problems, believe me, I have plenty of empathy, although sometimes I make light of some things. I have much empathy for all these things that have happened to us before we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, but it could not stunt our growth. That's what I want to get to you. We have to move on with this thing. That's what this thing is designed to do. That's what 6, 7, 8, and 9 are designed to do, is to free us from the nightmares of our past so we can live out there in the world today, in the sunshine. You stand out there, look at the snow falling. I saw a beautiful sight. I saw a lady standing with me. I thought, God, you know, she's praying to the sun god. You know, the snow is falling on her face. But I got out of the car, man. I thought, the snow is falling on my face. And I felt good and alive. Had a bowl of chili. Well, you give an alky a bowl of chili, you've got him, I'll tell you that. This last question. Got time for the last question. If a family member does not support your recovery, what do you do? There's not much you can do. I mean, I don't know why they do. My family is all gone now, except for my two daughters and my grandchildren. And my mother, God love her, died 3 years ago. She was 83. My mother never quit drinking. My mother, from time to time, would come and sit with you good folks. I watched this for 30 years. She'd come here and sit so she could no longer stand here, and then she'd go out and drink until she could no longer drink, and then she'd come back. She went in and out of this thing for 30 years. And my mother died, and I was sitting there holding her hand the day she died. And there was some surgery and some stuff that had to go on before she died. It was a very painful and degrading thing for her, but I was there through the whole situation. And if you would have walked up to my mother the day before she died, or while she was in the hospital, and you would have said to my mother, "Aren't you proud of your son, Johnny?" And he came out of that hellhole lifestyle that he lived in and got sober, and he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, in good standing. He works and pays, and he's a good man. It is nice that he recovered from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Not very many alcoholics do. You know what my mother would have told you? My son's not an alcoholic. He got better when he quit running around with them Mexicans. She believed that. My mother believed that. That my only problem, not that I was an alcoholic, my problem was I run around with these Mexicans. thought I was a Mexican. That's my mother thought. She says, when I quit acting like that, I got better. And in a way, she was right. When I quit acting like that, I got better. But my mother could never tie the thing, admit to her innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And she never did buy that. But in the sum total, she drank herself to death, too. Because she couldn't buy the fact that she was alcoholic. And a lot of parents, and I'm a parent, and my daughter, my youngest daughter, who's never seen me drink, neither one of my children have, neither one of my grandchildren, none of my five grandchildren have ever seen me drink. My oldest daughter, who was born and raised into Alcoholics Anonymous, into the same type of sitting her older sister was born into, in 1962, she was born. She's got 100 days sober at Alcoholics Anonymous today. 100. So I don't know. I don't know what it is. A lot of families, I'm a family member. A lot of family members think there's some type of a personal thing or some type of a personal reflection on them that you're alcoholic. And you hear people say all the time, hey, it's in here, family afterwards. Hey, how come you didn't get sober for me and the kids? And you went over there to them damn people in AA and got sober for them. How come is that? You don't love us? Yeah. Well, why do you do it? No, I just know I got to go to them damn meetings. Got to go over there and stay sober. Why? Why don't you stay here now that you don't drink anymore? Why do you have to keep going to them damn meetings? I don't know. Sponsor says I'm supposed to. You love your sponsor more than me? And it isn't. It isn't that the family doesn't love you, and it isn't that the family doesn't want to wish you well. I think it's just some type of reflection on the family's egotism that makes them think that they had something to do with your behavior. That's all. A lot of people who don't know, people outside of this room who are not alcoholics, who are not familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot of people in this room who are alcoholics, do not buy the concept of a disease called alcoholism. They do not think that this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body is a destroyer of people, places, things, circumstances, and conditions, and we have no control over it whatsoever. That nobody has ever figured out why we have it, and more importantly, nobody ever figured out who gets it and who doesn't. And people keep trying with all various things to prove they don't have it, to satisfy everybody out there that they don't have this thing. We try all kinds of various things. Prove I'm different. Every little quirk and quinny and every little emotional setback that I have in my life is trying to promote the idea in my head that I'm not really alcoholic. That I have some deep-seated emotional problems and I need deeper help. That may be true. I only know that I have been diagnosed clinically insane by one of the leading psychiatrists that the world has ever known, a guy by the name of Dr. Smith, who was the leading psychiatrist in the San Quentin State Penitentiary. Clinically, I'm insane. And you're listening to me. What does that do for you? I tell you that. And I came, I'm speaking from personal experience. I don't care where this falls or where it doesn't fall. I came in here, Alcoholics Anonymous, not because I was driven here under the lash of alcoholism. I came here out of curiosity to see the women who came into the institution. So I get no credit for anything that's happened to me since I've been here. And I discovered what was wrong with me, through a series of actions that this book outlines that I take. I didn't have a lot of sidetracking issues because I'm in a penitentiary. You don't have many sidetracking issues there. I'll tell you that. I just sit there. I had this book. My inability to buy whatever people, I kept having to support what people said to me through this book. That's what I had to do. If you made a statement, I went to this book. I didn't call my whatever or go talk to my buddies. What do they think about that? They look at me and say, shut up. Whatever you said to me, I verified through this book. And if it wasn't true in this book, I told you so. I remember one time, guy used to come up to that institution on a panel, and I didn't like him anyhow. Didn't like him. I just didn't like him. You don't have to like everybody. I didn't like him. I didn't like anybody anyhow, but him especially. And I sitting back there in the back row where I sit, checking things out. My shades on, of course, being cool so nobody recognized me. And this guy got up there, I never will forget this. The guy got up there that day and he said, blah, 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 whatever it was. Blah, 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 blah. And he held up this book. He says, it's in this book. Now, I'll tell you the kind of guy I am. I'll find out. I don't like him, but I'm going to find out. See, I didn't have contempt prior to investigation. See, that's what's bound to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. Is the principle of contempt prior to investigation. So don't talk to me about what you know in this damn thing if you ain't done it. If you ain't been sober as long as me sitting in these meetings, don't come and try to tell me some sidetracking issue that I'm not really interested in. If you want to do that crap, take it to all those sidetracking issues wherever you go. But I remember reading this book for a month. I mean, I went from page to page, all 64 pages. I read it night and day, trying to find out what he said, and it wasn't in there. God, I was happy. God, I'm going to get that so-and-so. God, I'm going to get him. Day before, Saturday, Sunday's coming. I know he's coming to his panel. Saturday, I just sit there. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk up there, and he's going to say it, and I'm going to say it, and he's going to say it, and I'm going to say it, and I'm going to hit him. That's what I'm going to do. God damn, I've been waiting for this opportunity for a year. I got ready. Didn't sleep all Saturday night. Crazy. Got up next morning, got dressed, showered, clean. Right over there by the gate. Here he comes. He walked up to me and he smiled. He said, hi, John. I said, you're a liar. He said, what? I said, you're a liar. You said it was in this book. I read it in there. What do you think about that? He said, so what? Walked off. I spent a whole month in absolute turmoil trying to prove what some guy said that I didn't like, that offended me, and I damn near went nuts, and I damn near blew my parole. Isn't that amazing? If I'd have hit that guy, they'd have locked me back up in the nut ward again, because my nature was attack people anyhow. Isn't that amazing? And yet, we have people sitting in meetings doing the same thing about everything that's said here. Any little thing that they don't want to believe, I'll punish that son of a bitch. I won't go back and listen to him anymore. I'm going to sit around and think about bad things for him. Go get a bowl of chili. Amazing, isn't it? And what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, we just share our experience, strength, and hope here. If you ain't got no experience, you ain't got no strength. And if you ain't got no strength, you sure as hell don't have no hope. So it's all part of the deal here. Part of the deal here. What is that old saying? You never want to criticize anybody until you walk a mile in their moccasins. That's Indian stuff, baby. I don't get into all this deep psychological stuff now. I may take you on a Hindu trip before long. But I hope by this particular point in our time that we have built us a little house in which we can sit down and be warm by the fire. And I hope that after we have a break and have a cup of coffee and go to the back room and come back in 15 minutes or so, that we can figure out how to keep our house. Let's have a little cup of coffee. Thank you.